So thank you guys, and happy to be giving a talk at this lovely conference, and thanks to all the other speakers who've gone before. This talk will be about these three papers, and the middle one is with Laura and Andrea Poom. So many thanks to them too. Okay, let's get into it. So at least, okay, so we sacrificed basically the bottom being cut off for a little bit there, but I think she'll be fine. So celestiolography, as you've probably seen a little bit in some of the earlier talks, including Romain's, is this proposed duality between gravitational scattering and asymptotically flat spacetimes and some CFT living on the celestial sphere. And the thing that I want to talk about today is kind of trying to merge where this story started from, with these soft operators as currents, all the way up to this new W-infinity symmetry that you heard a bit in Anna's talk and the end of Laurent's talk. And so the reason why we try to talk about this conformal boundary in terms of this 2D CFT is something that is alluded to in Romain's talk. It is a nice way to kind of interface between the stuff that you guys work on and Andy's group and friends that came out of that. And basically, one thing to point out in particular is that there really are two notions of infinite dimensional symmetry enhancements that are quite interesting. So in the beginning, and the thing that is what my talk is referring to at the cutting corners, it shouldn't be that I'm cutting too many corners in this short, in condensing everything for the talk, but that'll be a part of the pun. But the main reason why I'm calling the talk cutting corners is because of the way that we're viewing these soft operators as currents living on the 2D celestial sphere. But besides the understanding the asymptotic symmetry group and these cool infinite dimensional enhancements coming from going from Poincaré to BMS, say, or to BMS including super rotations, is one notion of infinite numbers of symmetries. And there's really now this whole tower that we're starting to explore that you saw in Anna's talk, in Laurent's talk at the end, which is kind of cool. So kind of spanning this whole line of work where it came out of is a lot of symmetries in this dual theory, and that's the main motivation for why we look for this 2D hologram. Okay, so what I want to, I'll repeat this at the end, but hopefully what this talk will get through a bit is trying to talk about the advantage of viewing Scry in terms of this dimensional reduction on the celestial sphere. And the point is that this program, this celestial CFT, is supposed to reorganize scattering in a way that makes the symmetries most manifest, and that includes both the infinite dimensional enhancement of the first kind, which we saw from this asymptotic symmetry group, so really building off of, for instance, my work from, my work builds off of Barnett and Trissers and others who noticed that the Virasoro symmetry could be there and not just the global Lorentz group, so that's really cool. And then basically, not only that, but also this further enhancement when we include this tower of conformally soft modes that Andrea and others have been working on too. And then finally, how these additional symmetries basically put interesting constraints in the S matrix. That's why this program will be valuable. And the key point of this talk today is talking about how when we treat this 2D theory in terms of like a radially quantized celestial CFT, that perspective of looking at the Rindler time slices is really playing a crucial role in each of these two cases. And so when I say cutting corners, I'll be referring to something along these lines about what exactly these Rindler time slices look like from the point of view of the bulk and the boundary, and the corner, which for us would normally be spatial infinity. Okay. If these slides get like lower and lower, we have to do something here. I feel like this is like a gradual, like the knife is coming down. Okay. So there's actually 8 bullet points in this outline, and someone on the computer is going to help me with this. But I feel like I'm in the tower, like the haunted mansion, like where it's just going down and down. Okay, that looks good. Yeah, so not to scare you even more with a list of 8 things, I figured since we're doing a long talk today, to break it up into little modular pieces. And the whole point of this talk would be to hopefully get it to appreciate how the people who work on celestial holography are really trying to merge techniques that you saw Romain and Laura talk about with basically what we're doing from the soft symmetry side and this dual perspective, and what you also saw with this infinite number of symmetries in Anna's talk. So hopefully I'm going to relate the flux story that Laura talked about this morning to the W infinity story that Anna's talk was about, and it'll be through a perspective that merges nicely with what you heard in Romain's talk. So hopefully we can just appreciate how all the people who are talking about celestial are attacking the same problem in ways that are complementary. And so we're gonna go through this little laundry list of notions that we want to make sure we appreciate. Okay, so the first one is the extrapolate dictionary, written in a weird equation to make us understand why things are nice at Scry when I talk about massless scattering. So in this talk, the main theme is, this is from like basically the cover art from Andy's paper, redone a little bit. And we want to understand this picture. And so just keep in mind, like, this will be the goal of the talk today, is to understand why we're really looking at everything in terms of this sphere and what, for instance, a state on some contour on the sphere would mean from this perspective. Let's just keep that in mind. We're after this flat space hologram. And we can merge two aspects of maybe what our precedents are for a hologram as follows. So on the one hand, in momentum space, we're going on shell, so that's one codimension, one object in some sense. But we really want to think about it in terms of flat limit of ADS CFT, and a lot of the people here today have done work on understanding how this flat limit, like the boundary conditions you need to allow like fluxes through scry. So there's that. And from my perspective, the only thing I care about is, okay, I'm taking my Cauchy slice and pushing it up to past or future null infinity so that I can think of preparing the in-state and the out-state in terms of data at the conformal boundary. So building off of Ashtekar and others there. Great. And so what is very easy for me, if I literally just want to do momentum space, is that things are even easier because of the fact that when I go out to large R and I hold my retarded time or my advanced time fixed, I get the saddle point approximation that basically localizes the direction I want to go in momentum space with where in the night sky I either put my detector or I'm looking at the correlator like of, say, a metric insertion there. So from my point of view, when you see what Romain and Laura and other their collaborators have talked about, I am very much thinking of their Carolian theory as the boundary limit of some correlators in my bulk. And so in particular, if I have a bulk that is, like, I can treat it as a perturbative bulk, then instead of in a quantum field theory approach, I'd be looking at correlators that are anywhere in this bulk. Instead, I'm looking at correlators restricted to the conformal boundary. And then I can talk about those correlators in any way. So if I smear along the generators of scry with a plane wave, then I get my momentum space amplitudes, but I can just as well choose different wave packets, and that'll be part of the story here too. So basically, the nice thing here, and I want to keep in mind what how this whole, so I would say a lot of the work of Strominger and others kind of comes out of this beautiful work that a lot of you guys are doing in position space a little bit more, so I'd say, where we try to understand how features of the S matrix lift to the space-time picture is where we really see how the asymptotic symmetry groups come from soft theorems. So many thanks to people in the audience for that. So now that we have the basis of this first bullet point of the extrapolate dictionary, doing everything in terms of correlators at scry, the second thing is when I say celestial holography, what do I mean? So I don't only just mean my flat hologram, I also mean that I'm in this particular boost basis. So let's just make sure we review how we set that up. Now I can start directly from momentum space. I don't think about these correlators in scry directly if I want to just start to build up my dictionary. And I have some on-shell states. And if I focus on massless scattering, it's a bit easier because then I can really just go to scry and not worry about time like infinity. And we know that Lorentz transformations of Minkowski space are going to be the global formal transformations of the celestial sphere. And so it really is just a choice of wave packet to get me from an S matrix element, which has some little group covariance for the external states, to instead having guys where I trade the energy out for a conformal dimension. And I have an object that transforms like a 2D correlator. But of course, I'm really just changing one coordinate for the other. So in this kind of dimensional reduction, I still have a continuous spectrum now of delta. But Anna Stuck is kind of talking about how you can look at maybe just the integer modes and things like this. So these are active questions. But in some sense, right now, all I'm doing is a change of basis. And so that's what I mean by celestial CFT. And then the two features to keep in mind are what I said about this continuous spectrum. So we're really not getting into that direction yet. And then the other thing is that collinear limits of scattering are going to be mapped to celestial OPE. So from the point of view of, I could kind of view celestial CFT two ways. One of them is that this program came out of trying to appreciate how all of this cool asymptotic symmetry analysis translates to features of the scattering matrix as normally presented in momentum space. And so the beautiful picture between position and momentum space realizations of the same thing are nice. And then the second thing would be, okay, so say I wanted to really do kind of what NEMA does, and I want to find some rules for this on-shell thing. I think it's really tantalizing to hear what Laurent was saying about this fluid system, this Carolian fluid. But you could also just say, I'm trying to bootstrap amplitudes from their soft and collinear limits. So that's the way that you would phrase the celestial CFT program as an attempt at the amplitudes program. Okay, so hopefully this little thing at the bottom will die. Oh, it doesn't matter. Okay. I don't know. I don't care.
No, you keep going.
I do care. Okay. So, okay. So now the next little module is Rindler evolution. So we've set up the thing. We have the, we have correlators at Scry. Great. So we're doing something holographic. We turn on quantum gravity, and the only thing we care about are operators at the boundary. We have this extrapolate dictionary, so it makes more sense when we have a perturbative book. But we're trying to map it to things in this codimension one right now. Carolian CFT, right? Basically. But now I'm saying, no, we want to dimensionally reduce. So we can just as well look at a basis of Boose eigenstates. And now let's really think about what that means from the bulk perspective to kind of see how it's weird from the point of view of the corners that we normally do. OK, so say right now I've said to talk about looking at kind of separate out, like say I have a scattering process and I have well-defined jet directions that are different directions in the night sky. And I want to really control the soft and collinear limit separately. The Boose basis is nice because basically of the following type of feature. If I think about when I Boose things, I'm doing this global conformal transformation of the celestial sphere, and I can think about moving those operators really close to each other and try to understand my celestial CFT from coincident limits. So when we're in these Boose eigenstates, then all of those external states have just a conformal dimension. Instead of the energies would I guess redshift or blueshift when I do a Boost. So we're in a basis that really prefers us to look at the flow of Rindler time in the bulk rather than normal time. And so one funny thing about it though is I look at the night sky and I do a Boost and I'm moving points on the night sky like around. That's a Euclidean direction. Like that two sphere is not Lorentzian. So I have to be a little bit careful when I call it Rindler time. I really want to be careful about whether I'm talking about what we normally think of as like the Rindler wedge versus the Rindler time outside of that Rindler wedge. And so I'll have a couple plots just to kind of show the visualization of how the Rindler wedge really barely intersects null infinity. And so we're really going to be thinking about slices through these regions, so outside of the Rindler wedge. And the point of the next two little mini modules is can we see how the soft theorem Ward identity equivalence maybe is more immediate from this perspective? And this is going to attach nicely to the flux story that Laura talked about. OK, so just as a first basic exercise, I have these coordinates that are naturally adapted for, I guess, Minkowski space, but like looking towards like future null infinity, because I'm using the retarded time here. If I just look at the locus where x3 is 0, so I just have a hyperplane, chops my bulk in half, what does it do to the celestial sphere? Well, the locus where it intersects the celestial sphere is going to be just the equator here. So absolute value of z squared is 1. So this slice will split the celestial sphere in a circle and also will run along the retarded time direction when I look at it near Scry. And so what I see now is that these slices, because they're codimensioned in a space-like direction, the boundary, they're also codimensioned in a space-like direction in such a manner that because of our order of limits where we take r to infinity first, we really are, in some sense, drawing a circle on the night sky and then that slice extends along the u direction. And so what we see is if I now take a Boost image of that same setup where this clean like slice right through the bulk, from the point of view of the bulk, the space of hyperplanes of the origin with space like normal should sweep out this hyperboloid. But when I do the same kind of Boost images of that equator on the celestial sphere, we know that Mobius transformations should map circles to circles. So basically for any such hyperplane in the bulk, I am thinking about some state on some circle of the celestial sphere in some place, I would say. So I tried to make some plots. Now, with mathematics, I had to draw it to get rid of some of the little artifacts, because this is just for you guys and not yet for anything where I'd need to make it very clean. But I want to just pause for a minute to show what I'm drawing. So I'm taking the standard Penrose compactification, right, like R and T in terms of U and V, like and the tangent coordinate, to make it so that from negative pi over 2 to pi over 2, like that would be the normal thing you would see in like Carroll's book. But now what I'm also showing is an extra direction so that we can really keep track of, in this case, the 3D version of the picture. And so what I want to point out, right, is this green one is the hyperplane that I was just drawing a couple slides ago. So I drew it like the picture on the right. Now if I look at some set of Boost images, say, towards the North Pole, I should basically see this opening angle here. So what I'm trying to draw here is this is a top-down view where I see what would be like the u-coordinate extending here, and that there are two points in the circle that a given hyperplane is intersecting, and those two points, is s0 would be a s1 if I were in higher dimension. And so what I'm basically trying to draw here is how you can see that these slices of constant Euclidean Rindler time are going to intersect future and past null infinity at the antipodal points like Andy uses in his antipodal matching, and then it sweeps through near spatial infinity. So I just thought it might help to have more pictures there because of the cup. I get some complaints when I draw this and then draw this and then say it's supposed to be intuitive. So if there's any questions here, I'm happy to also take it, but we can also come back to this side. Okay, so now we have this picture of, okay, if we really want to think of the first diagram on the cover of Andy's book, what a contour on the celestial sphere is and how that would lift into the bulk, I try to make an argument that the natural things are these surfaces. And let's review a little bit how we normally talk about the soft theorem reward identity. And so now this is more familiar to this audience. You have your metric, your scry, you're picking a convenient gauge, you know, specify some physical falloffs, and that kind of interplay between which falloffs do I allow, which large gauge transformations do I allow, kind of leads to these like ongoing debates over what really should be the asymptotic symmetry group. So, and that's cool. It's cool that it's much larger, that we have like these super translations and these super rotations, thanks to people, the second one, thanks to people in the audience. But again, like there is some still interplay between what we want to kind of allow to be violated, as far as like there's some debate over whether you want to allow diff S2 instead of just the Virasoro group, yada, yada. And so the fun thing that I'd say the Strominger group contributed was to what extent can we look at soft theorems as helping tell us which choice to make. And so in particular, like the first thing that led to this celestial CFT story was the fact that these asymptotic symmetry word identities could be just rephrased directly in terms of soft theorems. And so that's a starting point for me. But the way that one gets to, if one goes through the textbook to try to find like the cleanest derivation of it, there's still a lot of steps that maybe are a little bit less necessary. You really are starting from a point of view that you have a charge that's supposed to be like the past limit of one in the future. So you have a charge defined at scry plus minus, and you have another charge at scry minus plus, and you really need the antipodal matching condition to try to talk about a diagonal subgroup of those asymptotic symmetries that's supposed to be conserved. And so you have to use antipodal matching, you use constraint equations to then rewrite those guys in terms of fluxes, then add another contribution from time-like infinity, and now you have this relation where you can cancel the part here because of the antipodal matching, and in your S-matrix element, you group all of the soft terms and all the hard terms, and you have now your word identity. So now, mechanically, when you write these terms out, what you see is that eventually you really are kind of turning the charges here, the difference between charges here and here in terms of fluxes. So it's not like I'm doing much of anything technically new there, but it's a nice perspective to think, what if I have the celestial CFT and I really do want to kind of draw a surface that will kind of surround all of the places where my operators are smeared when I'm creating momentum or a boost eigenstate. And so those surfaces are going to be like the Rindler time ones that I talked about before. And so what's beautiful about that is if I try to just say, okay, I'm gonna take this contour on my celestial sphere and I'm gonna lift it to my bulk space time, and then I'm gonna evaluate the two form as the boundary of that. So since my corner, these slices, are, like as I was drawing, cut the corner, but you could also say that the corner of this slice is like a weird guy that extends along a time-like direction. And so these end up actually being the soft theorems. Our soft theorem is appropriately smeared along a contour. And so the simplest example is this U1 case. And in the U1 case, right, I just have my two-form flux. And in the standard picture, I always be starting by writing the two-form at spatial infinity. And so for its slice that's, say, a Cauchy slice, it intersects, basically goes out to I0, and then I have my FUR component. But if instead I look at the same two-form for a surface that is my constant Rindler time, what I see is I have some contour integral along that state on the celestial sphere, and then it extends in the U direction, and there's some other contribution from scry minus. And so it's kind of cute that this is already the radiative component. So in some sense, one could say the fact that the soft theorem is the word identity, well, the soft theorem is literally some insertion of this canonical charge for these weird slices. So it's just another take on that perspective, but I think it's kind of nice because then that kind of maybe leads to maybe a reason why some of the fluxes that Romain and Laura are working on would maybe be the natural ones, or at least they're definitely natural from a celestial CFT perspective. And they really are, in some sense, I don't know if the topological is quite the right way of phrasing it, but they're operators on the, like defined on these surfaces through the bulk that are really boundary terms. So it's kind of fun to just go directly to that, especially with this motivation from celestial CFT. And so just to keep in mind, whatever, you can do the same manipulations to get back to your standard soft and hard-worn identity. But the point is if that surface doesn't intersect any hard pieces right now, there's a sense in which you really just start with the soft insertions. So that's nice. Okay. We don't. Okay. So what I want to point out here is that the radial equals windmill revolution picture kind of jumps us directly to the fact that these soft operators in the bulk are generating symmetries on the celestial CFT from the point of view of the Rindler evolution. There are radial evolution on the celestial CFT. And we further see that this codimension 2 hologram isn't really super weird. It's really like ADS CFT in the sense that we're saying the charges in the boundary equals the charges in the bulk, but we're just slicing the bulk in a weird way if we take seriously radial evolution in the celestial CFT. And so it kind of is more consistent with that thing. It really points out, though, that this, I think it's in favor of the Carolean picture in the sense that we have this codimension 1 hologram, it's just on this weird null surface. And the thing that we're kind of learning here is that we can somehow gain something by slicing up that boundary in different ways. So can I try to then later, in the last part of the talk, see that this basis might be a better way to present the flat space hologram? So the next part of the talk,
question maybe, because you went fast on the...
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
To say, no, before, like, so I'm trying to understand, so, you know, if I, okay, you're saying these time-like planes that create this kind of a separation on the celestial sphere, and now, but then you want to, maybe I missed the point of what you want to do with this cut on the sphere.
Yeah, so
is that what's coming, or it's supposed to be contained there?
Okay, so what I wanted to do with the cut was show that the canonical charge, so the charges that I'm saying are acting on that cut in the bulk are the soft theorems, sorry. So to me...
Oh, you mean... Okay.
So what I'm saying is you automatically get the antipodally matched insertion of the soft charge just from looking at the canonical charge on these cuts through the bulk. So that's one thing that I wanted to point out, right, is that basically here this U integral of FBU is just, like, coming from the slice. So that's one thing.
And how does that work? Like, because you're looking at one side of the...
Yeah. So, but then in the same way that I, so in the same way that the, so that's just one insertion, and then I can, of course, relate it to, like, either way about deforming. So any slice that has that same boundary, if I wanted to construct the full word identity, then I would basically need to take, like, two ways of deforming the boundary, so I can have, basically push it out to scry, and I would do the same thing where I would say the charge is equal to whatever is on the one side and the other, and have basically what I'm drawing here. Right, whatever your value for the lambda is, you can use the equations of motion to basically capture any hard parts and soft parts if you wanted to. But to me, the more interesting thing is if I, strictly speaking, was able to insert things away from any other charge insertions, could I understand that the flux algebra has to work out, for instance, because of the fact that I know that it's formally just the canonical charges on this slice. So, how do I want to phrase it?
Maybe can I? So, yeah. So what I get when you say there should be a geometrical interpretation of this antipodal matching. If I stay in the purple region and I follow a Rindler observer, I'm necessarily exchanging these two sides, right? So I'm following.
So with the Rindler, if I look at the, sorry, so the purple slice is basically another slice that hugs scry that basically has the same boundary as the Rindler slice in some sense.
Yeah, okay.
And so that's the type of trick one would do to write normally like a north pole and a south pole contribution to the full word identity. But I think that there's a step in there kind of intermediate, which is that the fact that if I just literally look at the charge itself now is the soft theorem. So to what extent you would expect the soft charges to obey whatever algebra, and this is the abelian case, so it doesn't really become as interesting. If you can go from the step where you have this charge algebra that's consistent, that would already be a statement about the soft operators being some representation of it. So that's part of what I think is cool. But it's a little different than setting up the word identity, which is for the word identity, you're just matching two sides of the thing. Because it's the same boundary now. Instead of, the only difference is that normally the two guys that you're matching are really across spatial infinity, and so they're infinitely time separated apart.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do want to say, though, is that if you insert this away from any, if the total charge is now only a soft contribution because there are no, it's just the flux in some sense there, then there might be something interesting here in the same way that normally, you would have, say, bonding mass and then soft and hard, and then try to check the algebra of the soft and hard term separately, versus here you might see that the soft theorems themselves should encode that. Okay. Good. Is that, does that answer your question now? Great. Okay, cool. So now what I want to jump to is this Q soft plus Q hard equals zero thing. So basically, what I have is the following statement, is that in this picture of like the final word at n is where you've canceled the body mass A term, what you have is you have a total charge, which we want to think of as breaking up into irreducible reps of whatever symmetry group. So on the one hand, this is supposed to just be from the radiative piece. And so if you look at, say, this equation Laurent's asking about, this would come from the part that is just the flux still, no matter. And the point is that here, this soft term, basically you start with a spin S mode, and then there may be some derivatives on it or whatnot here to get you down to a representation of the same symmetry group that acts only on the hard charges. And so the fact that you can have, in some sense, or the fact that you're like, oh, you're still matching across the surface to have an expression where like soft equals hard is interesting because, again, of the fact that basically it's not obvious that basically you can also decouple these two. So let me say, okay, so what I first want to point out is if I just look at the SL2C representations, then if I have a given weight for my conformal primary operators, then I have a primary descendant from this SL2C whenever my weights are such that I basically have this quantity here being zero. And so I similarly have that for SL2C bar. And then when both conditions are met, I would have a set of nested primary descendants. And so the statement that I have a primary descendant that decouples is literally the statement of a conservation law. So in sense, like the stress tensor, one derivative of it is zero, it would be sitting at some guy here. One derivative down is this guy at the corner. So what I want to point out is for the particular case of the spin memory and the super rotations, which are the kind of Goldstone mode, canonically paired to the memory effect. And so in this case, we have some soft graviton theorem. There's a shadow that defines us, this dimension 2 operator, that descends to what would be the soft charge in this expression, which is a dimension 3 operator. And what's curious enough is if you look at like Cordova and Chow's work, if I got rid of gravity, so I really decouple it, I still have a dimension 3 operator sitting here. And so you can do the analysis of like a free matter theory and look at the dimensions of different like soft operators that you can have, and then how they couple to gravity. And so both of these guys have to have the same symmetry transformations if you really want to have like a factorized Hilbert space, I think, in some sense you could say. So why we do celestial CFT isn't just because we have the Lorentz group, it's also because when we couple to gravity, we seem to think that our quasi-primary operators get promoted to Virasoro primaries. And so if we follow through with that, then very naively, the first at the tree-level approximation, we have an expression for our stress tensor, and we have some notion of the vacuum degree of freedom, so some super-rotation, that this thing will induce a change in the vacuum state. Now, what was beautiful about this paper by Romain and Laura is that by basically demanding that the soft and hard expressions transform covariantly under the appropriate asymptotic symmetry group, they actually get higher-order corrections to the stress tensor. And so what nice thing comes out of trying to demand the celestial symmetries, in some sense, is that you can actually get the loop corrections from that. And so what's beautiful about it is if you just compare it to some earlier papers in the literature, there was a proposal for the loop correction to the stress tensor that was just matching the soft theorems. But there is a slight disconnect here because basically they had one particular switch out of an explicit IR divergent kind of regulator here and a memory mode instead of a Goldstone mode for the same thing. And so the lesson here is trust the symmetry, so trust what you guys are doing over just matching soft theorems. And what you see is that at the time, they didn't quite fully appreciate the Goldstone mode, how it dressed the operators and interpret those IR divergences as coming from that. And so you indeed see that the expression in Laurent Romain's paper would be the one that you want. So that's nice. And so this is another instance of really looking at the symmetries, tells you something about the S matrix side of things. And then the next thing, which follows again from matching the weights, but in this case for the SL2C, is that you start from SL2C multiple structure, and this is what I said before, but now let's see not just one particular conformal dimension that I care about, but instead find what are the full sets of primary descendants that I would find, and I would identify tower of symmetries for my spin 2 graviton if, because I have a continuous spectrum, I can analytically continue that to any value of the conformal dimension such that this condition is satisfied. And so these are the ones that are in Anna's talk. Basically, normally, if I was in momentum space, I would have some low energy expansion of my amplitude, starting with a Weinberg pole, but then going order by order in omega. And so those should each turn into poles in the S matrix. But when I do that, it's unclear necessarily how many are going to be universal. And so, again, treating the system like as if it were a radially quantized celestial CFT is what came, what originated this W infinity story, because they're looking at collinear limits of gravitons and then computing this complexified version of a radial commutator and getting the symmetry algebra. So basically, the commutation relations that correspond to this whole like W infinity story that's been exciting recently come from treating the celestial CFT like it's some complexified version of a radially quantized of 2D CFT. And so, again, this is where the symmetries are coming in, because I wouldn't have known that I could go to these basically weights and maybe expect some primary descendants to couple and have a tower of symmetries if I weren't really treating this theory like it was 2D, and in more than one way, because I'm also using these commutation relations to identify algebra. So what I want to point out now in this final part is kind of the celestial versus Corollian points of view to tie into other speakers this conference. And so basically what I've argued here is, okay, so the celestial program is basically looking at Rindler evolution in the Bulkin boundary. And so the soft theorems are canonical charges. Literally, the soft operators smeared on some surface are the canonical charge for a cut of the bulk that is constant Rindler time. And then the in and out come together antipodally when it comes to like those insertions are already antipodally matched by the time they limit to future or Pascal infinity. And then besides that, if I am talking about states in the celestial CFT, and I seem to find that there, at least in some either MHV case or whatnot, I do have a decoupling of the primary descendants in this SL2C, and that gives me this infinite tower of symmetries that I would not have expected just from an asymptotic symmetry analysis per se, versus in the Corollian picture. It's natural from the point of view of thinking of like, okay, I have this three-dimensional manifold that I'm going to, but of course you have some sort of things fluxing, like living through scry that you have to be careful about with like conservation laws. And so you also need to worry about matching in and out, and this is handled in Romain and Laura's paper. So I would say the position basis lends itself naturally for this asymptotic symmetry analysis and understanding memory effect experience, for instance, but then one runs into this question of, is it physical to talk about overleading gauge transformations or to extend, modify the phase space that you're interested in? In momentum space, we see these first soft theorems as nice, but it really is like a question of how far subleading can we go? And so the synopsis of what I was talking about today is basically how we see that these two notions of infinite dimensional symmetry enhancements are tied to maybe things that we would expect if we really treat this system like a 2D CFT. And treating it as such is really just a particular way of cutting through this three-dimensional hologram and kind of dimensionally reducing it. And so that's how this radial quantization picture is playing a role here. And we hope that they'll give us interesting constraints in the S matrix that this particular dimensional reduction is useful. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sabrina, for the talk. So, questions? Watch out, you have.
Thanks. Sorry, since I didn't manage to ask this question to Laura before,
yeah.
I'm wondering about to what extent. So what are the assumptions that go into the calculation of scattering amplitudes involving these Goldstone modes as external states?
Yes, okay. So, okay, the naive thing would be like that it's, right, there's no pole in some of these. So what I want to say is that the first thing when I would, if I was just looking at S matrix element and trying to find it, I think that there is, for instance, the superrotation mode would be a pole at a conformal dimension where there is no pole. So it looks like in the scattering matrix, you're not seeing that background. But I think that there's probably a way to handle it with sources or something like that. Like maybe, like if you literally do the asymptotic, I mean, in principle, when you're inserting a soft charge, you are changing the background. So like if you formally know how to exponentiate that, then I think you could, in principle, define like scattering on one of these like backgrounds with different values of C. My attitude.
I see, but you'd say that there is still some work to do there to understand what insertions of, because there is this assumption on, you know, you're using the two-point function of the Goldstone modes to calculate these guys, but do we know that that would hold for all sorts of amplitudes, or do you think
it, seems to work for your conal guy. So what I'm saying is the following. So I agree with you that there is some disconnect between understanding the, so the thing that's confusing is sometimes when you think of, the C insertion on the normal vacuum is somehow assumed to be zero, and then we have all of our dressed operators have this kind of link between, how a C correlator acts on it and how the memory effect acts on it. So I think that there's some disconnect between when we're doing perturbative computations and treating it like a Fock space, and then actually being able to write down the classical the metrics C. Yeah, I think it would be interesting to understand that better, but I still think it's at the level of something weird when we're talking about perturbative amplitudes, and then how we introduce the loop order effects. But,
thank you.
Yeah.
So you mentioned universality for these subleading soft theorems.
Yes.
Could you comment about it? So in particular, are these symmetries, do you expect them to survive are they expected to be a property of pure gravity? Or
yeah.
Do they survive also in the presence of matter?
I think that the subleading soft theorem in gravity survives. Now, all subleading down, I am up for debate on it. So for instance, So for me, okay. So my attitude with so the one thing that happens at these canonical charges that you don't see it for the further U moments of say the metric in some sense is that you basically don't have in some sense the Bonnie Masterm canceling between in and out. But in principle, So what I would say is that it's not obvious to me that. At least from my work, but I think I would defer this to Laurent, how the rest of the tower would persist. But I think what Laurent's work is cooler because it doesn't seem to rely on only, the celestial OPE version kind of really restricts you to being self-dual gravity or self-dual Yang-Mills to talk about the symmetries. And I think that your presentation is much less chiral in some sense. I am curious right now, there's some fun things to try to compare it to the actual 4D CFT literature. But that's too in progress to say anything there. But I assert that yes, for the subleading soft graviton, I'd say that the standard stress tensor has zero central charge, and I'd say that Donet and collaborators' results are key to that interpretation. But I would not be as assertive with the more subleading things, but I would still assert that you can still group everything in terms of conformal dimensions, so there might be some way around saying there's a conservation law, but there's more terms instead of just a soft flux and a hard flux. If worse came to worse, I know I could say something like that, but that's not really useful yet. So, yeah.
All right, Sabrina, there is a question on the chat from Lee. He's asking whether matching left and right reps of SL2C is similar to what people call a simplicity constraint in spin form.
Uh-oh. I think I need to call a friend or something, phone a friend for that. I don't know. I don't know what the second half of that is. But, I mean, I guess as an optimistic scientist, I would say yes. And as a pessimistic scientist, I would say, of course not. No. I think everything. If everything these are the same representations, they're probably related somehow. But,
very good.
Is there another question?
Any further questions?
Maybe I can ask a question since we have time.
Yeah.
It's a question I want to ask since we have time, in the sense that it's just a wondering. It's not really something very concrete. How much would you be able to say about different dimensions?
Yes. Okay, good. So what I would say is that I am confident that you can still write things in terms of correlators in a D-2 CFT. This picture with cutting the spheres would still work in higher D. So you still have this picture of how you're kind of dimensionally reducing this scry down. The statement that there are soft theorems would still indicate that there should be operators there. There's something nicer about not having Virasoro symmetry in that I can use this kind of shadow basis and always have my stress tensor and the other currents. I put every operator in what is called the shadow basis, and I think there are ward identities coming from the soft theorems that are fine. So there's something nicer there, but there's something weirder about the Goldstone mode interpretation because it seems a little bit weird to try to like add overleading modes, for instance. So I guess to what extent maybe it's more natural to think of the soft stress and insertions in terms of like the matter, like the hard charges instead. I don't know what I would do with the like the IR sector of the S matrix in that case, but I do think a lot of the machinery in terms of representations of the matter CFT and then how gravity couples to it would hold fine. But there's something weird about the like the Goldstone modes, I think. Like maybe. Yeah.
Yay. Hey. What is the status of BMS in higher dimension?
Yeah, so I think the status that I, as I was aware of it, was that there were arguments that you could just basically add an overleading to your gauge super translation that was, in some sense, symplectically bare before you reduce to some constraint subspace that would kill it normally because it's overleading, where you can make sense of it. But I don't know how much I'm trying to think how much I care about it, because I definitely do care about it from the point of view of, like, when I want to talk about, I don't want to say something that will get in the way of what I want to be cool, which is like this like kind of soft, hard vectorization of the Hilbert space in the horizon in particular seems to have interesting implications for like black hole information and stuff like that. So if I start killing this whole notion of an IR sector, it's cry, I don't want to be like, I'll ruin that. So I don't want to ruin that. So I think I said what where I was at, which was the paper by, was it Anna and Monica that kind of disagreed with Wald and said, yes, you could make sense of this higher dimensional super translations. But I think people in the audience would be have more informed opinions about why they would, in their framework, not want to say that. I'm saying the canonically paired guys are there, and there's some constraint in the Hilbert space that relates soft and hard, and that's most of what I need. But do I need to say that that soft hard also shifts some vacuum? That's the debate. I guess it could be a debate. I've seen both sides of that.
Okay, so.
Thank you.
There's no more questions. Let's thank Sabrina again.
Thank you.